Welcome back to another episode of Silk Flowers and
Paper Mache Hearts.
On this episode, we will be finishing up our interview with Steve Yunkins from Q2Q Comics. So thank you again for sitting down with us, Steve.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
So we talked a lot about the comic last week, but let's talk a bit about your sound design work, even though this is a props podcast. Because one thing we found out since last week was that you actually do a lot of Foley work for your sound design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do a lot of live recording and field recording with sound effects, and I have a special interest in Foley work and actually making stuff, especially live on stage. I had a show that I did a few years back that was It's a Wonderful Life, the radio play. And we staged it pretty straight as a, you know, inside of a recording studio, and we had the actors actually manipulating all the sound effects, which calls for in the script, but it was like an enlightening experience for me to sit there and think, okay, how are we going to make this? And I had to work with the prop master to, like, we kind of split it as a, how it sounds was my job and how it looks was their job. And so we kind of worked together to find, you know, the more than, what was it, like 35 or 40 effects that they had to use in the show, and you know, like crinkling cornflakes with baby shoes to make steps in snow, and like squeezing cornstarch and trying to solve, like, you know, how do you make a car door opening and closing. I actually had to be a carpenter in that, and I had to build a half-size door, a little like full a slamming door, which had like three or four different locks on it and or different clasps on it, and they could close it and open it and make all the effects they needed. We sat there, we just had the full table in full view of the audience, and they could see and watch what we were manipulating as we were making it. And then I kind of took that as I started doing like different design work. A lot of the stuff that I would do was like soundscape building and world building stuff for a lot of devised pieces that they had to do. And so I would make, you know, 2.5 hours of strange noises and try to, instead of just finding canned effects or doing that, we didn't really have a budget. And so I would make a lot of them myself, and I would find ways to record the effects. One of my favorites was for production, and it was a devised production of Frankenstein. We had to have this, like, moving through guts kind of noise, which was kind of his, like, Dr. Frankenstein's work, and like part of his scientific process was this, like, digging through all these cadavers. And so the sound effect that I found for it was watering down peanut butter and just squishing it between my fingers. It was an entire day of doing that, of just splurking noises the whole time. And there's a comic about that out there, where Steve is squishing peanut butter going, what the hell even is my job?
I'm getting paid for this.
Yeah. The little Foley door is actually on the first time that my girlfriend had gone with me to my girlfriend, who was a props carpenter, as we talked about. She had gone with me to the Maryland Ensemble Theater. I was so proud to show her this Foley door and a wind machine that I had made, and they were just these garbage constructions that were poorly painted brown, and I was so proud of them. And she's like, yeah, great job. I don't even think she said great. I think she was just kind of aghast at these things, like, oh, that made it on stage. I stay out of the carpentry world now.
That's okay.
No, I mean, I enjoy finding, you know, how to do effects and, yeah, how to do that.
What kind of research do you do to find these items to create specific sounds? Is it just experience, or?
A lot of it is experimenting, is trying to, like, oh, I've done this, or I've heard this before, or I've seen, you know, I've heard this particular chair squeak in a way that sounds exactly like a, you know, a screen door swinging in the wind. And like, you try to, you are always listening for things and trying to hear things. And it used to be, I would have my laptop and a little USB mic with me everywhere I went, and I would just record weird sounds because I was that kid. Like, there was a particular chair. It was in a community college classroom that they were these, like, spring-loaded swing-in chairs that were, like, two of them on a frame. And one of them squeaked the worst squeak that I have ever heard. And I have that squeak. I recorded it, and it is in my library, and I used to use it all the time as my go-to squeak. And yeah, you build up a library of stuff you've got. And then you trade it to. There are a couple of good websites. There's the Free Sound Project out there where people will take their field recordings and post them. And I've got a number of stuff posted on there too. They're all either like an attribution license or free licenses, and you can use them, or some of them you pay for and whatnot. But it's mostly just trying to get everyone access to that kind of content. But yeah, to find out stuff, like if you're like, how the hell am I supposed to make an engine noise when I don't have a car that I can fit in here? And if you Google it, it's just going to say the best way is to get a car in there. you just start experimenting, and you know, you remember being a kid and putting a baseball card in your bike spokes and the noise that it made to make a fake engine, and thinking, can I use that? Can I affect that? Start with it and you work with it.
So besides the peanut butter for the guts, what's the sound you created where the item making the sound is the farthest away from what the sound is actually representing?
I can tell you about a couple of other found sound stuff that you wouldn't have expected to be in a show, as opposed to, I think that might be a little easier. We did Waiting for Godot in college, because of course you do, and we got kicked out of our main theater space for mold remediation, which again, of course you do. And so we were in this very old music hall that the theater company is now banned from using because we ruined the stage. That's a different story though. And so the sound design for that was one very long cue of just kind of incidental background noise that's faded up for a solid 2 hours, starting before house opened and then ending with a sharp mute cutoff right on before the last line of the play. As they're walking off, and it's just, shall we, cut. Mm-hmm. And the last line is done with this, you know, abject silence. It was my neighbor mowing his lawn outside of my door, outside of my window, plus me sitting there at the mic making spooky wind noises, kind of things. And there was a fan. My cat walked across the mic a couple of times during that, and it was a series of just like 30-minute recording sessions that I layered over each other. Just to make noise, and it was just like the background noise of your brain. And so then you take it and you start at, you know, no sound and slowly raise the volume up, you know, 70 decibels over the course of 2 hours, and people don't know that it's being done to them until you turn it off. And then once you turn it off, there's just this like stark clarity to the entire room. And so that was where the effect was like this psychological warfare against the audience. Mm-hmm. And the actual sound was my neighbor mowing the lawn. There are a couple like that. I do like the cornstarch is one of my favorites for stepping in snow or like dried leaves. You squeeze a box of cornstarch. That's a basic one, but it sticks with me because every time I have to buy cornstarch, or I pick it up, or I see it in the pantry, I have to squeeze it. It's crick, crick, crick. I do a lot of them vocally too. Like if I can't find a good sound effect, I'll just make the noise and then affect the voice and run through a number of what's the word I'm even looking for?
Filters.
Filters, that's the word. I'm a professional and I know all the words about all the things that I do. It's actually one of the things that my assistant has to do constantly is, like, I will forget the names of basic things. Like, we'll be, you know, deep in a discussion of our signal flow, and I'll be like, okay, but this thing, that, what is that thing? And she will know exactly what I'm talking about, and sometimes will clue me in on what it is I'm talking about.
So you mentioned that, you know, you buy, for example, cornstarch. Are there other items that are expected for you to purchase, or do you collaborate with props and ask, oh, we need this, do you have this in stock?
Usually, if we need an effect for stage, it becomes a prop. If an actor is going to manipulate it, then it's going to be a prop, and sound kind of sticks out of it. But if it has to be, if it has to sound a certain way, or if it's, you know, it needs to be of a certain quality, then I will usually have a lot of input on what it is exactly, and say this is what's going to make that sound, but then leave it up to the prop master to find the right one for the right period for the show, because that's their expertise and not mine. Yeah, and usually it'll be, okay, well, I found this bell, will this bell work? And you know, we'll go through and see what we can do. Or we'll both sit there and go through stock and just pull drawers of stuff out and be like, oh, well, we've got this, will this work? And that's mostly just me, you know, flicking things and smacking things against other things, trying to find stuff and seeing what works. Yeah, one of my favorites from college was a, we couldn't get this doorbell cue to work right. It was a shop door. You know, they open the door and the bell jingles. And we couldn't get the damn thing to work right. We couldn't time it right. We couldn't see when the actors were entering. Nothing ever looked right. And so we wound up having the actors, when they walked up onto the set from behind, there was a bell on the wall, and they would ring the bell and let it go and then walk through the door. And it took us a long time to find the right bell, and then they kept breaking the bell. And it was kind of
what?
A nightmare.
Breaking something?
No, no. Ooh, they would never.
That's crazy.
Yeah. The bell that we wound up using, what we found at a yard sale across the street from the school, that was an antique that had a bottle opener on one end, and the bell. It was neat.
Have you ever had to work with music instruments on the stage where you had to provide them? It's always a gray area between props and sounds when the actor has to play a music instrument.
My general thought is that how it sounds is my job and how it looks is yours. And so usually if it's an object that has to be purchased for the show, then it's, you know, up to props to procure it. And the maintenance of it, though, like right now we have, we're doing a show that has a violin and a saxophone on stage. And it is the sound department's responsibility to make sure that they are tuned and, you know, everything is right with them before they go on stage. But it is the, but yeah, it's stage management's job to preset them and props job to, you know, if they break, they will be replacing them. We're doing a show that's double cast, and so we have two completely different sets of actors doing it, and so they each have to have their own violin and their own saxophone. It's a bit of an ordeal.
Just a bit.
But actually, our actors are, they have permission to take them home and practice with them, even though the whole gag is that they're terrible at playing them. So, we're 3 weeks into a run, and now they're getting too good at the instruments, and eventually the note's going to come down.
Like,
that they
no,
have to,
no, stop.
They have to be worse at them. And actually, because they've been practicing with them, they're pretty good at keeping them in tune on their own, and so there hasn't been much work that we've had to do for it, except making sure that they exist. after that got out of the rehearsal hall, it kind of fell off of our plate a little bit, that there wasn't much that we had to do with it. Yeah, the sound department and rehearsal were taking care of it mostly, and then by the time I got in there at the designer run, one, I didn't even know that there was going to be actual musical instruments on stage that had never come up in a production meeting.
That never happens.
Glossed over it in reading the script, because I read the script.
what?
The who? I missed it, and so I got in there, and then she's like, oh, and you're going to take care of the violin and the saxophone. I was like, aha, that's a funny joke.
Then it's reality.
Yep. But I think actually for this show, in this case, the instruments are rentals, and they were done through the sound department. The props didn't have to pay any money for them.
Oh, that's how. That's what I like to hear.
Yeah, I'm that person that the director will be like, you know, it needs to sound a certain way, but not this way. And I'll be like, well, you know, that sounds like a sound thing, not a prop thing.
At OU, they just did a show that had a guitar on stage, and they had three guitars in stock, and they were all beaten to hell and broken into pieces. And so Liz took me up there and was like, okay, you have these guitars. Can you make one of them work? It's like, I'm not even a student. I don't even go here. Yeah, my recommendation was to buy one, and then I gave them recommendations of where to buy one for cheap, and then they gave them a rehearsal one, and they liked the look of the rehearsal one better than the one they bought.
Of course.
And yet we don't get consulted for things like, if you have a ship's bell ringing in the distance, they will say things like, oh, either has to be a sound cue, even though it's going to sound better if you have somebody ringing a bell off stage, which is super easy to do. And then they don't consult us when the actors are having trouble ringing the bell. Like, oh, how do you make it make good sound? It's like, well, I'm just sitting here. You can ask me if you want to, but...
this is funnier to watch you figure it out.
There's a cart that it's like a little child's fire truck kind of thing that has a bell on it, and it's attached to a handle, and props has rigged it so when she pulls the handle while she's pulling it away, it'll ring the bell. Except that in order for the bell to ring, the actual, what's it called, has to reset. So it can't be in contact with the actual body of the bell. And so when you pull it, if you just keep pulling it, it's just going to rest there and you're going to get a thunk and no other noise. And if you want to ring out, you have to ding and release it. But nobody asks me. I'm just the sound guy.
You're just there. Now, with the bell that you just mentioned, you said that it would sound better if it was off stage. How often do you do Folly effects that are performed off stage? Because I know some people have done it once in a while, but I'm not really familiar with how often that is.
For me, it's one of my favorite things to do is that I can, if you want it to be, to sound a certain way, it almost always sounds better if it's done live rather than putting it in the can and playing it back, especially if it has to be locational and it's something easy. Cause if, like the options are either you play the bell through the house and then you just hear it everywhere, or you put a speaker in and then you have a fake bell sound coming from a location where you've then added equipment and cable runs and time to actually doing it. Whereas the bell, you can just put it off stage and have someone who's already there ring it. and yeah, I tend to advocate for doing things live, but I also, you know, I have the background to help with that. I've done it before. I know how to do it. And also, if we're working with something where it's one effect in a show, and it's we work in such a small house that you can do something like that just off stage, or you can use the actor's mic to have it close mic'd instead of that, and you get the sense of both location coming from stage and also actual audibility in the house, so you can kind of blend them that way. But... yeah, no, for a lot of things, I'm very in favor of doing them on stage. Gunshots especially, it drives me nuts when people try to can gunshots. Like, as much as it needs to be a conversation about using things like starter pistols and blanks, it from the sound side, it's going to sound better if you do it on stage most of the time.
Yeah. There's been so many times that a director will be like, oh, that's not the right sound. And I'm like, that's how the gun sounds. Like, that is real. What do you want?
So I do that. If I get a note like that where that's not what the gun sounds like, the first thing I'll do is show them that this is an actual recording of that same firearm being discharged. like a video that I found, it's the same sound. And then the other thing I have is a... it's a like cowboy gun Smith & Wesson recording that I paid for way back when that I just keep. And it's like, this is what you think a gunshot should sound like. This is not what that gun sounds like. and then you lose anyway because they're like, oh, well, this is what I want. Realism be damned. And, you know, the director gets what they want then. Like, you at least you put up the fight. And then, you know, when people complain that it's the wrong gunshot, then... all the, you know, the sound designers and props artisans that show up at the show are like, that's the wrong effect for that gun. That's what that gun sounds like.
That's the wrong time period. You're like, oh my gosh. I know. I tried. I failed. Leave it alone.
Yeah, there's a comic about that.
Yeah, we do a lot of live gunshots, even if they're backstage. We just did Our Town, which the script actually calls for a lot of sort of like... on stage Foley effects kind of thing, and that was a real collaboration between sound and props, because it's like, this is what I'm giving you. If you want it to sound different, it's a little out of my area of expertise.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know how to tune a milk bottle. I'm sorry.
I do.
See, there you go, we needed a sound designer for that show.
Right. Yeah, you can add water to it if you want it to be a different tone. You can put water in. You can put any solid object, reduce the resonant cavity to it. You just did ask me.
We didn't think about it.
Yeah, the other challenge was the bells. We found a bunch of different bells, but then at the very end, they want, you know, church bells ringing in the distance. And it's kind of like, unless you have that, you know, 10-foot diameter bell, I don't know how to get that much, you know, resonance mm-hmm. out of a tiny little dinner bell.
And you have a bell meeting where you ring each mm-hmm. bell. And they're like, no, a little higher pitch. And you're like, I don't know what you want.
Mm-hmm. And I actually came across somebody had ripped out a 17th century church bell and they had it for sale at their antique shop. And it was, you know, the cost of my entire budget that I had already spent. So I could have, like, effectively doubled my budget. So I kept that in the back of my head just in case they were never happy with the sound of the bell. I could be like, well, if you want to spend the money, I know where there's a real church bell from the 1700s.
If you don't have to ring it on stage, you take your audio engineer with their field recording setup, you go to the antique store, and you hit it once.
Don't mind us, we're just testing this.
I have an answer for the question about the sound effect that was most different on stage. I thought of one.
Okay.
So we had to do a show where someone had to break glass, like throw a glass on the ground and have it shatter, and we needed a glass breaking effect. And we didn't want to play it through the house. We wanted, again, locational sound, and we didn't have the equipment to run something out there. And so making it Foley was my first suggestion, and they're like, okay, make it work. And one of the best breaking glass effects you can do is taking, drum chimes, like the kinds you would see in a drum kit, where they have a series of different, lengths and are tonal, and, you layer them over top of each other and you put them on a towel or some other deadening surface, and then you run a shot glass over top of them and it'll sound like broken glass because it's that sharp impact and then immediately deadened. And it really works. But the problem we ran into is that, and we had used that effect in It's a Wonderful Life a few years earlier, and so the issue we were running into was there was no good way to make that sound happen, like, as sharply and as quickly. And so what we found was we switched them from using, like, a lighter plastic to a more solid acrylic cup. Mm-hmm. And so he would drink from it and then he would throw it into this milk crate that we had lined with a towel and put drum chimes in. And it was deep enough where he could hurl it in there, just threw it straight down. We hit it behind a bar. And so he'd walk up there, he'd drink it and he'd throw it down and it would sound like it was glass shattering. It was a perfect effect. And again, locational, it was the right sound quality, the right volume. And there was no... And because it was such an intimate house, we didn't have to mic it. It was just right there. I say intimate, I mean small.
So with sound, there's always crossover with props. There's always large speakers wanting to be put in very tiny props. So let's talk about all that. Why? Why do you do this to us? No, I'm kidding. I'm assuming it's mostly because of locational and all that jazz.
Yeah, a lot of it is we are being told that we need to have sound coming from a certain place for a certain thing, and like some things always sound better when they're in a specific location instead of coming through the whole house.
And especially like a radio.
Yeah, where if it's playing through the house, it completely feels different than if it's sitting on a table somewhere. That if the audience can't place it. We did it for Drowsy Chaperone. We did our curtain speech as an answering machine message. And so we had his answering machine on stage, and there was a speaker installed underneath the table there. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty well hidden. And we would play both through that speaker and through the house a little bit, the whole speech. And it would give them the sense of location because they can hear it coming from that spot, but there's still audibility in the entire building. It still actually sounds like you can still hear it and understand it. And so you can place it in addition to understanding it. There's stuff like that. Yeah, jukeboxes. I hate playing jukeboxes. That's a headache for props. It's a headache for electrics if you have to put lights in it and have them work. And it's a headache for sound because you pretty much have to gut them to fit a speaker in there that's going to be big enough to make any sense.
And do you gut them or do you expect props to gut them?
For us, it would be props that would take care of that. Props would gut them, and then it would usually be if they're not being billed, if it's something that's being purchased and then repurposed, then yeah, mm-hmm. they would take care of all of that and outfit it. And then electrics would usually be in there after us, and then we would be the last thing to shove our giant heavy speaker in it. And mm-hmm. Usually it's a collaboration then, because it's like, this is what needs to go in there. If you need to do anything to make sure that it doesn't move, we would appreciate it.
And do you ever try to run the sound through the speaker that's already there in the jukebox or any other?
Almost never.
No.
Almost never. Yeah. Like, even if you can try to make it work, like, it's almost never right. And mm-hmm. may not work with your system, and it's usually mm-hmm. easier, to run your own cable and have the actual control over it. You just don't have the control of the sound quality with it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, has there ever been a time where the director or you guys wanted to have a specific speaker or even a mic in a prop or just generally on stage that just did not work? And how did you resolve that?
Oh, okay. So the worst is when the directors want these like 1960s style, like the big silver mics to stand on a mic stand that has to be used on stage.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they want it to be real and they want it to work. They're so expensive. And if you want them to actually look right, if you care about what they look like, then you almost have to go vintage with them. The modern reproductions don't look right. Mm-hmm. There are some great ones that are like matte finished or like brushed aluminum that don't reflect as much light.
Mm-hmm.
But if your director has gone and Googled a picture of a microphone, then they liked it, then you don't really get much choice in it. And then things like that, if it has to be a functional mic on stage, that's sound's responsibility to take care of. But yeah, we've had times where we bought a mic, or we had a donated mic actually, mm-hmm. that fit on stage, but they needed two of them. And so we used, props built a housing for another mic that we already had. And they built it to look like the first one and just inserted our mic into it. and it worked. Like, if you didn't look too closely at it, it was fine.
Yeah, there was a time I did a Vita, and you know, the moment where she's at the microphone and there's like five or six microphones right there of
yeah.
different styles in the same time period. And of course, one of them had to be real. And for some reason, we were the ones that had to find that. I still don't know how that ended up on my plate. But it was so frustrating because, you know, you had like a crappy little homemade microphone because it was the only thing you could find in stock and you have no budget. And you have this real microphone, you know, it just kind of looked ridiculous. But yeah, those microphones are pretty tricky with that time period. I do have to agree.
My least favorite request is for a prop master to come and ask if we have any real mics that they can drop on stage for an effect. Or my favorite is, do you have anything that's in stock that's like broken that we could just have? It's like, no, we maintain all of our equipment. If it was broken, we wouldn't have it. I've also like,
yeah, we have had a stock of broken things,
but if they were broken, I would happily hand them off and you can have them then.
Yeah, I see people drop the mic all the time. That's a sound person's favorite new
makes
thing.
Makes my heart break for you guys.
Oh, and the request is always that when it drops, you hear feedback, which is not what you would hear when a mic hits the floor. It's like so one of the things that my girlfriend and I talk about constantly are the, like in TV shows, she gets bothered when you see people holding coffee cups that obviously have nothing in them and
yes.
the actors can't play
oh
the
my
wing.
Gosh.
And so it's like, where's the prop person that should have put, you know, washers in the bottom of that or something just to weight it? And mine is anytime you hear anything that's supposed to be coming from a microphone, there's feedback first, which mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. every audio engineer in the world cringes, at having to do that.
Right. Yeah. It's the, whenever the awkward person steps up to the mic, it's like feedback, tap yep. the mic. Oh, sorry. Like, what's feeding back?
And there's so many better ways to do that. Like, you can actually make them sound reinforced instead of just, you know, having it feedback. Like mm-hmm. people accept it. You walk into a microphone, you're going to assume that it's working, but whatever. It's okay. I feel like, so what bothers
pretend.
Me about it, it bothers me more is that like, I don't get the same courtesy that if somebody walks up to my mic and it feeds back, I don't just get, oh yes, that mic is working. It's Steve, what the hell? Also, you're fired.
And goodbye.
Cool. Do you ever have to deal with ringing cell phones on stage? I know that's kind of a constant headache for props mm-hmm. people. And we sometimes turn to the sound department to kind of fix it for us.
Yeah, I haven't had to do it myself. Like, I haven't had to have a phone look like it was ringing on stage. I know other people that have had to do it. And I know there are a lot of apps out there now that, like, you can have an actual phone on stage and you can fake ring it from other things.
Mm-hmm.
Which tend to do that. But they're another thing that makes more sense to have, like, locational sound for. That if you play a cell phone ringing in the house, like, no one's going to be able to place where it is or what it is. Yeah, I mean, technology's getting better for that. We have the benefit of having more apps that'll take care of it for you, and then you don't really have to deal with it. Trying to have a stock of cell phones sucks, but I feel like that gets into the prop territory then. Like, again, it's how it sounds is my job. But yeah, and then for me, it's, you know, if you pick to have like a, you know, a Motorola Razr on stage, then I have to find the appropriate cell phone ringtone from whatever year. Then I have to worry about it being period correct.
Now, I've been, I think I've only been to one place that did this, but I recall that they had somebody actually call the person on stage to get that effect. And I would think that's such a horrible idea.
Yeah, that's a bad idea, I'd say.
I mean, you would never, like, what if you don't get the connection right or anything like that? If a director were to come up to you and really fight for that idea, how would you handle that? I'm sure, maybe.
It's one of those where you say, okay, these are the reasons that it could fail. Like, these are the ways that it could be inconsistent and could, you know, take people out of the show. And then this is how you make it work consistently. Like, I'd approach it as a consistency problem. Because, yeah, you're right. Like, you could not have the connection. You could not have the reception. The person could have accidentally silenced it. Whose job is it to check their phone if it's someone's personal property to make sure that it's set correctly? And so, yeah, the more you can control, the better. Like, you got to take all the risk out of it. Because if you can't do it consistently, then it shouldn't be on stage.
Yeah, my dream is kind of like a dummy phone that just has a speaker and a light inside, and you don't have to deal with any apps or Wi-Fi or anything. You just hit go.
How do you trigger it though? Like,
just you gotta wireless come up with a DMX. Small enough. I don't know. That's why it's an idea, and I'm not a millionaire.
Yeah, where's RC4 when you need them?
What's the smallest RC4 you could get?
No, you have to have. It needs an actual cable. It has to be hardwired in. You have the phone stuck on a DMX line.
Classic.
All right. I guess we have time for one more question. We haven't talked anything about Q2Q this week, so maybe we should end on a Q2Q question.
Sure.
So when they do the Q2Q musical, who would you want to write the music for it?
Okay, so I feel like this was supposed to be a funny question, but
this is serious. This is
or deep and insightful.
Give us the dirt.
Well, when I was a boy, there's a group in Chicago that currently has the development rights to do a Q2Q musical. So
they're
currently working on writing music for it. I haven't heard any of it yet. I am getting a little nervous. But yeah, they are currently, there is a group currently developing it. I don't think I can give any other, like, actual details for it at the moment. But
we'll figure it out.
Yep, someone is working on it, and I will talk about it if there is more to talk about in the future.
Nice.
Yeah, so, if the question is, who do I want to write the music for a Q2Q musical, like, hypothetically, the answer is anyone that is not me, please. Don't make me do it myself.
So you'll probably be doing it yourself.
I mean, I've done my share of compositions, but it's mostly for it's not for musicals. I'm not that kind of musician.
Yeah, because it's completely different. It's a completely different art.
Yeah, I mean, there was a time in my life where I was a touring musician, but that's different. That's a completely different podcast.
We'll get there in a few weeks, guys. Okay, well, thank you, everyone, for listening in. And it's been so great talking with you, Steve.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me again.
Of course.
And remember to check out his website, q2qcomics.com.
That's the one.
Anything else you want to plug?
No, I think that's it for me.
Just the comics.
Just
do that. Yeah, I guess. No.
If anyone has any questions, please email us at propspodcast@gmail.com. And you can also follow us on Twitter at SilkMache. And we have been your hosts,
Eric Hart
and Ashley Flowers. We'll see you next time.
Bye.